Hi there, and welcome to the Skylight Books author reading series. If you'd like to learn more about us and our many upcoming author events, please visit skylightbooks.com, where you can browse our inventory, buy books, and join our Friends with Benefits Club. You can also follow us on Twitter, Tumblr, and Facebook. To speak to a real live bookseller like me, please call 323-660-1175. Thanks for your support, and enjoy.
Ngugi Wa Thiong'o is a leading writer and scholar at work today, currently serving as Distinguished Professor of English and Comparative Literature at UC Irvine. His prior books include Wizard of the Crow, A Grain of Wheat, Weep Not, Child, The River Between, Petals of Blood, and Birth of a Dreamweaver. His latest, Wrestling with the Devil, has already received fantastic praise. Publishers Weekly described it as at once exhilarating and defiant. Ngugi Wa Thiong'o's memoir is a thought-provoking document of a grim time in Kenyan history. Alongside detailing his own experience, Ngugi explores philosophical questions of individual will and traces a history of neocolonial Kenya that, decades later, feels deeply relevant today. We're delighted to have him here tonight to read and discuss Wrestling with the Devil, a prison memoir. So please help me welcome Ngugi Wa Thiong'o.
Under the title Detained. By that one, because of the immediacy or the moment, the kind of, you know, political situation in the country at the time, it also contained a lot of documents, you know, like, you know, fighting and so other documents of slightly outdated by now because the events, you know, changed a lot in Kenya, you know. But then I realized that the essential thing of that memoir was not so much all those documentaries and so on, documentation, but rather the aesthetic of resistance embodied in my writing a novel in prison on toilet paper. So I redeveloped it a little bit to really focus on that experience, you know, of writing a novel in prison, you know, as a form, really, very frankly, as a form of resistance. Yeah. And in the process, I realized that imagination is the most incredible phenomenon we have. that, in a sense, dictatorships and repressive regime or repressive conditions, all they're trying to do is really diminish the capacity of the human to imagine new possibilities or different possibilities, really. My theory is that these writers, people who deal with words, they tend to also be people who, they don't have any weapons around them. They don't carry arms, you know. They don't have armies. What they have are words. And what words do, they excite imagination, they expand our imagination, you know, look at possibilities. Many repressive regimes like to think. Oh yeah, thank you very much. Yeah. They like to think, or make people think, that this is the best of all possible worlds. You know? Feudalism used to think the same way. This is the best of all possible worlds. You know? Slave systems used to think this is the best of all possible worlds. Why would anybody want to either get out of it or rebel against it? You know, what better world could there be? You know, and I think writers and people who deal with words and art and imagination, I always say, you know, sort of, we can imagine a more human world. Yeah. So I see imagination as that which also helps. Imagination can break through barriers, you know, and this is what I found in the prison that I could. Since I was not allowed to get any information about what happened outside the prison, committed maximum security prison, but I still could have conversation with people. I could kill my own people. I could have conversation with the outside through art, through writing, in this case, you know, a novel. So let me give you a little bit of context here. In 1977, as a professor of literature, and while working as a professor of literature at Nairobi University and chair of the department, but also being a published author of at least four novels, The River Between, With No Child, A Grain of Wheat, and the later then, Petal of the Blood, I still found myself, through a long history, I won't go into it, having to work in the village with ordinary men and women to develop a theater which is rooted among the people. And the thing is, most writers in Africa, including myself then, wrote in English, but in a society where, quite frankly, only about 10% use English, and most of the population, you know, really have their own languages and so on. So going to work in the village meant working, if I wanted to do something about theater in the village, meant working in the language spoken by that community. I think it'd be ridiculous to go there and say, hey guys, I know you don't understand English, but really, let's have a people's theater in English. It wouldn't make any sense. So, I have a dry cough, not a flu, but a dry cough, a bronchial something. So, we developed theater in my mother tongue, the Koyo language, through a play called I'll Marry When I Want, you know, which was very successful, really, in so many ways. People seeing themselves in their own language, ordinary men, you know, we used factory workers, you know, plantation workers, the landless and so on, you know. And it was really fun, people talking about themselves and so on. But we didn't realize that people talking about themselves and saying we are seems to be quite threatening to, or that the government acted in a manner that surprised us. We shouldn't have been surprised, but we were surprised that the government banned the play on 11 June, November 1977, and on midnight of December 1977, I found myself in a much, January 1, 1978, I was in a maximum security prison. So the question is, how do I survive? An intellectual, academic, use of books, paper, and so on. Yeah, you know, and now without books, without a name, without everything, you know, in a maximum security prison. So this memoir really is about that, wrestling with the devil. It's really wrestling with the devil, not only in the sense of devil as evil, but also wrestling with the devil of the devil on the cross, which is the title of the novel that I wrote in prison on toilet paper. Okay, so wrestling with the devil meant to carry those multiple implications, but focusing mainly on writing Devil on the Cross on toilet paper. So I think that's sort of read sections, you know, and reading prison memoirs is not very pretty. To be very frank, I'd far rather be reading a novel.
Sometimes in case you get drunk.
Oh, yeah. This way? Let me see. Are you the same as this? No. This.
We're just in the
middle. Yeah, let me try this. Maybe more.
Yeah,
help
yourself. Okay.
I
have the same cough.
Oh, you have the same cough? Oh, okay. Then. Can I keep them here for a little while? I'll give them back to you. So, I'm telling you, reading a memoir of prison is not sort of the thing you look forward to doing, so on. It brings back memories and so on. But at the same time, the novel I wrote in prison, I stand out with the first modern novel in Igbo language. And since then, it and my thoughts on writing in African languages has created a whole debate. And my book, Decolonizing the Mind, which was a development of the thoughts I was having in prison about languages, has become one of my most recognized texts literally in the world. I just come from India right now, actually, where from Calcutta to New Delhi, Bangalore to Hyderabad, people to one, and from the advanced community to university students, you know. The one thing they had all in common is decolonizing the mind. And these were thoughts which I developed when in prison. So let me go to the memoir right away. Section 4. Yeah, section 4. In this memoir, I do have one advantage. I was able to have this, I don't know if you can see it, but this is an example of the toilet paper I was using. So, this one. They were kind of square, a bit hard on the body, but very good writing material. I think we're meant to punish prisoners, I think. But, you know, pretty good writing material. Held the pen very, very well, yeah. Now, before I do that, let me say, some writing can be very prophetic not always in the best possible way. And just before I was arrested, I had just published a novel called Petals of Blood, which literally opens with, it was published in July 1975, and I was imprisoned in December 77, 2 years later. And this novel opens literally, Petals of Blood opens with, let me actually open with the novel a little bit. because this is pure fiction. What I have here is pure fiction. So I read the arrest of at least five characters. I'll just read one of the small section. Abdallah sat on a chair outside his hovel in the section of Eau Marron called the New Jerusalem. He looked at his bandaged left hand. He had not been kept long at the hospital. He felt strangely calm and so on. And of course then there's he raised his head and saw a police constable or police officer looking at him. Abdallah? Yes. I am a policeman on duty. You are wanted at the police station. Now? Yes. Will it take long? I don't know. They want you to record a statement and to answer a few questions. That's all right. Let me put this chair back inside the house. But at the station, they locked him up in a cell. Abdallah protested against the deception, and so on and so on. But at the police station, they locked him up in a cell. Now, that was fiction, remember, published in July of 1975, I think. Now, this is not fiction, okay? So remember that, fiction, real world. They came for me at midnight. It was December 30th, 1977, at my home in Limuru, Kenya. Two Land Rovers with police officers armed with machine guns, rifles, and pistols drove into the yard. A sedan flashing red and blue on its roof remained at the main gate, very much like the biblical sword of fire policing the ejection of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden by a God who did not want humans to eat from the fruit tree of knowledge. The stability of Adamic Eden depended on its residents remain ignorant about the accommodation. Behind the sedan were others that, as I later came to learn, carried some local administrative officials and corps of informers. The latter remained lurking in the shadows for fear that, even at such a dark hour, some peasants around might recognize them and denounce them to the people. Armed members of the intelligence, then known as the Special Branch, who summed my study amid an awe-inspiring silence, were additionally guarded by uniformed police officers carrying long-range rifles. Their grim, determined faces lit up only a little whenever they pounced on any book or pamphlet bearing the names of Marx, Engels, or Lenin. I tried to lift the weight of silence in the room by remarking that If Lenin, Marx, or Engels were all they were after, I could save much time and energy by showing them the shelves where these dangerous three were hiding. The leader of the book reading squad was not amused by my remark. He growled at me. So I took his advice and let them do their work without the verbal interruptions. But I kept on darting my eyes from one raider to the other in case they planted something illegal, like banned pamphlets, so as to then claim they found them hidden among my other books. But I was alone, and there were many, all over the study. I soon realized the futility of my vigilance, like the prisoner in a poem who warned the reader, and that's from, I think, from Latin America. Like the prisoner in a poem who warned the reader that it's no use, you are hiding deep in the dark well of your house, hiding your words. Burning your books, it's no use. They will come to find you in lorries piled high with leaflets, with the letters no one ever wrote to you. They'll fill your passport with stamps from countries where you've never been. They'll drag you away like some dead dog, and that night you'll find out all about torture in the dark room where all the foul odors of the world are bred. It's no use. You are hiding from the fight, my friend. Nevertheless, in helpless light silence, my eyes never strayed from the raiders' activities. To the list of the work of the dangerous three, they now added Kim Ji-ha's, the South Korean poet, Kim Ji-ha's Cry of the People, and any book whose title contained the words scientific socialism. And then they saw a pile of copies of Gaita Deda, the play we had been performing with the community. They crowded around it, each taking a copy, flipping through it, and then added the copies to the loot. Mm-hmm. It's too sweet. Okay. They had arrested the prescript. It seemed they had accomplished their mission. The conversation in my living room went something like this. I asked, go get me. Gentlemen, can I request that we sit down and record all the books and pamphlets you have taken? Police, we shall do all that at the police station. Tell me quite frankly, am I under arrest? Oh no. In that case, I'll provide you with a table, pen and paper, and we can record everything before it leaves the house. We shall do it at the police station, and you are coming with us. What for? To answer a few questions. So, am I under arrest? No. In that case, can the questions wait until morning? No. Can you please give me a minute with my wife to sort out one thing or two? It is not necessary. We promise that you'll be back in the morning. Just a few questions. So can you tell me where you are taking me so that my wife here can know? Tigoni, that's a local station. This was an abduction. Tigoni. And of course, when I went there, like my character, I was locked in a cell, and who are recently disappeared. This was an abduction. Still, I couldn't help musing over the fact that the police squadron was armed to the teeth to abduct a writer whose only acts of violent resistance were safely between the hard and soft covers of books. Now, being in prison, one of the very horrifying things, you know, being in prison, especially, okay, let me also explain this. In for us, I was not convicted. It's not that I was taken to a court of law, and I was charged with a crime, and then convicted, and then jailed for so many years. Literally, it's from my house to a maximum security jail, my name, without my name, everything, I'm just, you know, a number, you know. And they have horrifying stories. For a few weeks, I was kept in what's called intern isolation. There are others there in the same block, political detainees. But even then, they're not allowed to speak to me. And it's something horrifying. Being isolated, you are seeing people, but you cannot talk to them. You know, it's all like you are reminded of people every single hour, but also you are reminded you begin to doubt yourself a little bit. You know, you feel as if there's something wrong with me. And although I must say, some of the prisoners were very good. They would, although to allow to talk to me, they would keep within the law, stand at this and talk among themselves. But they were talking to me, you know. But they were talking about, you know, giving each other warning, or you know, you must be very, in this place we have learned to be very strong, you know, to do this and that. But they are telling you, but they are telling themselves, so they will, yeah. But by the time I get the first visitor, I'm tense inside. So I'm going to read all my encounters in prison. And he happened to be a priest. They always bring a priest. By the way, I found that although there were no books, not paper, but there are two books, generally, the Quran and the Bible. Those were there. The first verbal victim and the visitors was priests, yeah. The first verbal victim was a prison chaplain. What happened by my sort of anger, whatever it was, you know, soon found an outlet in words. The first victim was a prison chaplain who one morning came into my cell, staggering under the weight of two huge Bibles, the Living Bible in English, and in Gikuyu, in Korean Gai, the Holy Bible, and one in English, one in Gikuyu, plus a bundle of revivalist tracts from the American Millionaire Rich Evangelical Missions. He was in prison, in a prison officer's uniform of khaki trousers and jumper coat with aluminum buttons and a decoration of two or three stones on his shoulder flaps. You know. He was a prison officer really with the color of the priest here. He also carried the hallmark of all prison officers and warders, a cord over the left shoulder, carrying a whistle hidden in the breast pocket. Underneath this symbol of oppression, he wore the holy uniform of a reverend, a black cloak with a white collar around the neck. I held my tongue and let him talk. Sometimes, he said after sitting on the edge of the desk, sit with me on the bed, God chastises us for our own good. Take Mau Mau for reasons. Mau Mau was the Liberation Army that fought against the British in Kenya. Take Mau Mau for reasons. Mau Mau was God's scourge with which he lashed Kenyans to teach them a good lesson. But as an African priest, the fruit of this lesson, well learned, is the stability we now enjoy and which is the envy of our neighbors, that the post-colonial thing. I could hardly believe my ears. Kenya Land and Freedom Army, otherwise known as Mau Mau, as the British called the soldiers of liberation, who, with their sacrifice and courage, wrote the most glorious chapter in our nation's long history of struggle, was to this man with the cloak of a priest beneath a prison officer's uniform, a huge sabre or whip with which God flagellated Kenyans into humble submission to his eternal will. We have all sinned and come short of the glory of God, he said. Who knows, maybe this is a unique God-created chance for you to meet with Christ. Then he went on. You see, God works in mysterious ways his wonders to perform. He did see the anger seething inside me. In my silence, he could see only a being about to be smitten to the ground by the thunderbolt of the Lord, like the soul, like Saul in the New Testament. But to me, his attempts at the verbal comfort sounded like prayers of thanksgiving for being chosen to be the earthly instrument of God's mysterious ways of performing his wonders. And his attempts at converting me were trumpets of victory of a foreign foe of imperialist Christendom. My silence lured him on. He now presented me with two Bibles. The Bible is the only book in the world containing within it hardcover a complete library, he said, fingering each Bible lovingly as he placed it on the desk. The six books in one. Oh, how many people can boast of a home library that big? He then handed me two religious tracts, one of which was God's City in Heaven, or some such title, with all his awe at the American manufactured weightless leaves of holiness. Despite my mounting anger, I beat a hasty retreat from his verbal onslaught and Lasher took the leaves. I really felt very weak before the moral uncertainty of a man who had walked the same path over and over again and hence knows every sharp corner and dangerous bend, every nook and brook on the way. A man who knows clearly from years of experience where his path leads to a prisoner's acceptance to carry the cross forever without a murmur of discontent, because he now has the spiritual satisfaction of having Christ for a personal savior. The visit had been beautifully timed. For over 2 weeks now, I had not engaged in any debate. Indeed, I had hardly talked to anyone at any length since the night I was abducted from home. I had been denied human company. At the time of his visit, all the other political prisoners, except, I've mentioned a few, Martin Shikuku, had gone to Shimola Tewa prison in Mombasa to meet the review of tribunal. The review tribunal to review. So I was totally alone. I felt as if I were on the run, relentlessly pursued by an invisible, silent, malignant force that, despite my every effort to distance it, had finally caught up with me and was now transforming me, a free agent, able to make decisions, into a passive creature, panting and cringing for mercy at the feet of the twin warders of the body and the soul. My hard anger had now melted into a kind of spiritual lethargy and intellectual torpidity. What's the point of talking back? Is it easier for me, for everybody, possibly for me, to buy peace with silence? The priest sensed the uncertainty in his quarry. He now took out his spiritual dagger and went for the kill. Let us kneel down and ask God for forgiveness for all our sins, he commanded. But in a voice tear-bathed in infinite pity and compassion. And suddenly, from somewhere in the depths of my being, rose a strong, rebellious voice. It said, wake up from your spiritual lethargy and intellectual torpor. Don't let them drag you with this stuff. Don't let them poison your system with it. It was to make you acutely hunger and thirst for a compassionate human voice that they have kept you near and yet far from human company. If you let him get away with this, you'll not be his prisoner for the rest of your stay here and probably forever. And that I felt life stir. Hold it, I cried out. Who needs your prayers, your Bibles, your leaves of holiness, all manufactured and packed in America? Why do you always preach humility and acceptance of sins to the victims of oppression? Why is it that you never preach to the oppressor? Go, take your Bibles, your prayers, your leaves of holiness to them who have chained us in this dungeon. Have you read the play, Guy Cadeda? Did you ever go to see the play? What was wrong with it? Tell me, what was wrong with Camerino peasants and workers wanting to change their lives through their own collective efforts instead of always being made passive recipients of charity meant to buy peace and keep sleep and to buy peace and sleep for uneasy heads? Tell me truthfully, what drove you people to suppress the collective effort of a whole village? What has your Christianity to say to oppression and exploitation of ordinary people? I was getting worked up. A few guards crowded the door, but I didn't care. I fled Reich's rotten roots, his spiritual dependence on imperial foreigners. What had made him bring me tracts written by Billy Graham? Did he know that this was the same man who used to bless American soldiers on their mission to napalm, bomb, murder, and massacre Vietnamese men, women, and children in the name of anti-communist Holy Crusade? Were there no Kenyans who could also write sermons? Why hadn't he at least paid homage to Kenya's spiritual independence by bringing into prison sermons by the likes of Reverend John Gatto and Bishop very outspoken Kenyan priests, by the way, men whose liberal sincerity and concern had led them into a measure of patriotism? My transitory vehemence shook him. He became defensive. The moral uncertainty had gone. Avoiding the ugly issues of oppression, exploitation, and foreign control, he said as a man of God, he never indulged in politics. To justify that stand, he quoted the biblical exhortation to believers to render unto Caesar things that are Caesar's, and unto God things that are God's. I quickly quoted back to him the biblical scene in which Jesus whipped out of God's other temple the Pharisee and Sadducees, collaborators with Caesar's oppressive rule. A little game started. He referred to me to biblical passages that talked of faith, sin, salvation, grace, and life after death. I would in turn refer him to alternative passages in which God is cited as having sent his prophets to denounce earthly misrule and oppression of innocence. He abruptly cut short the heated exchange. Anyway, we could go on arguing forever, but I've got others to see. You educated people like argument too much. But remember, you cannot argue your way to heaven. Later in the memoir, I do actually acknowledge that actually he, in the heat of the moment, I was also a little bit too too aggressive. Please.
No word.
Excuse me.
Just try. Have a seat. I think I was a bit. So what should I do now?
I have no other solution.
Okay.
You left him hot tea. Okay. I don't have to do so.
Okay. Okay. Me try.
Yeah. I mean, I've been too aggressive, you know. Yeah, actually, anyway, I do talk about it in the memoir later. I do actually acknowledge that actually he, later I learned, despite his apparent aggression and so on, he had actually been sent by some friendly people to see how I was. And I think his kind of very aggressiveness and hostility may have been also a cover. So I was a little bit too clever by half, as I learned later, you know. And I found also in prison, not every warder was necessarily hostile, but their way of helping you sometimes meant that they had to show a lot of hostility, verbally, loudly, you know, like one who came and told me very bad things, shouting. And then he told me, there's a committee in London fighting for your release. And then you would get into very loudly, you know. So these are tricks which I would learn later. But at the beginning, I was all they, me against them, whoever they were. Okay? Yeah. I'm saying this because I learned that in real life, things are a little bit more, not always black and white. That even among imprisoning authorities, it doesn't mean that everybody who is working for a system necessarily shares all the values and all that, you know, system. I'm going to, you meet in prison, life is generally a cliche, you know, I mean it's mundane, you know, you repeat the same thing over and over again. Especially in a political detention, because you're not really convicted, so they don't even. So life in prison is not all endless confrontation and profound meditation on history. It is basically a cliche, dull, mundane, downright monotonous, repetitious, torturous in its intended animal rhythm of eating, defecating, sleeping, eating, defecating, sleeping. It's the rhythm of animals in a cage waiting for slaughter or escape from laughter at the death, not of their own fixing and all that. Now, but I try to observe a few characters. I want to just read one, because people cope in prison in different ways. It can break you. Okay, I didn't believe it can break anybody, but I also believe that resistance in any form is very important. And the resistance for me does not have to be that you are banging at the door, and it can be small ways, you know, but you must find a way of saying no in different ways, because only through resistance does life occur. It's a kind of life, you know. Now, but otherwise you cope in different ways with prison. Not in the case of one person whom I met there, who was actually quite interesting. Let me explain. Among our prisoners was one who had been arrested in connection with a military coup. Not quite a coup, but plot, a plot or something. But anyway, you see, that probably his may have been an error. You know, the one who souped along with, you're drinking with some friends who are old and or who are military, and he swept along with them anyway. But I did not know that at the time when I met him. The military man is a man of many. The military man, I shall call him. I don't call him by his name here. He has been here for 3 years. He keeps to himself. He had a came to my door to say hello. But the moment my internal segregation ends, he befriends me. This intensifies after we discover we both like chess. We are chess and checkers, we are allowed. Chess and checkers are some of the few games allowed. Checkers is the more popular. Some of the prisoners breathe and swear by it. But military man looks down upon it. He was used to a daily chess company of another military officer. They used to play it with great intensity, as if they were indeed commanding armies in a battlefield. Besides their belief past, chess was what set them apart. But then those officer was transferred to another jail, so he was left all alone, so didn't have anybody to maneuver military armies on a chessboard. So between the departure of the officer and my arrival on the scene, he had nobody to play chess with. For a military man does not deign to teach others. It is. Chess becomes the special knowledge that he possesses, and the others, civilians, don't. But I'm a little different. Being a professor and a writer compensates for my lack of military background. Plus, I already know how to play chess. And he notices, after a few checkmates, that I'm able to outmaneuver him on the chessboard. Initially, some of them express an interest and the desire to learn, and I teach them the names of the pieces and their moves. Much this chagrin of military man who likes it that is a game known to a few. But she's not upset for long. For the moment the other discover that chess is not like checkers but calls for more concentration, they abandon it one by one. And in the end, only military man and I are left to it, confirming to the military man his view that chess calls for superior minds. At first, the others, even when they do not play, would watch military man and me play, but after time, they don't even stop at our sessions. Later, I learned the rumor that has driven them away. A few even tried to discourage me for my own sanity. Chess and the concentration it calls for, even watching it, can make one crazy, and they think that military man is a little crazy. But I don't care. He regales me with stories, not so much of his actual military experience, but the aura that surrounds it. He hints that he had indeed been privy to a military plot to overthrow the Kenyatta regime, and sometimes he himself was somehow in the thick of it. But he never divulges details of what, who, when, where, and how. But the very lack of details and His mysterious looks makes his involvement seem bigger than he was letting on. The more I listened, the more extraordinary his hints and claim became. Sometimes he would tell me, without details, that he had trained with the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, that he'd even met Arafat, who was then head of PLO. He talked about some of the leading figures in the organization. Just before my own incarceration, there had been a few news over the arrest of two Palestinians in Nairobi Airport. Now the little man swore to me into secrecy. Then he divulged the secret. They had been sent by the top PLO leadership to rescue him from committed prison. Despite the setbacks, the plans to spring him from prison were still afoot. His stories make him look larger than life, although this was in contrast to his haggard prisoner bearing. Then one of the prisoners once takes me aside one day, and he tells me word for word the story the beaten man must have been telling me. What? Had he been listening? No. It was because he and others had been recipient of those stories before. It stands out, according to Koi, that military man had never been in military service, but he happened to be social friends with some in the military, later arrested and detained without trial for being suspected of plotting a coup. The real military officer, the chess partner who came before me, had told on him. He's a victim of social contact. At any rate, he was never in the military. But since his imprisonment without trial, he's internalized the military thing, and in his mind, he was really in the military. Then I asked, what about his seemingly good knowledge of PLO, and even naming some of the leaders and actors in the Middle East? Well, there was a period, according to my informant, before my time, when they, the prisoner, were allowed newspapers, and the military man had an incredible memory that retained all the details. He had a way of inserting himself in his stories in a manner that seemed convincing, except that the logic dictated the contrary. Plus, the real military officer who had been transferred had told them the truth. Well, actually, I became even more interested in his fiction. You see, he lived in a fantasy in which brave men would eventually rescue him. And when angry with the prison officials, he'd hint at some kind of retribution. Whatever it is, the fantasy, I suppose, keeps hope alive. Hope. And one is hope in his hopeless place. And does it matter how one gets it? Whether from religious faith or in the rightness of one's political beliefs, or in the stories of a military man sustained by dreams of a giant dramatic rescue. Yeah. Me, I turned to writing, to fantasy of writing, I suppose. And that's how I came to write, Devil on the Cross, on toilet paper. How much are we doing for time?
It's 8:40.
Huh?
8:40.
So I can read a few pieces more?
Or
hot?
Yeah. I think we should do, maybe open it up for questions, and then so we have time for deciding.
Okay, so I can read one more piece, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe one more piece. Now, you can read how I came to be writing the novel in prison and all that, but there's something else which since we are detained without, we are detained without trial, we never know what the problem with detention without trial is. That you can be theoretically be released after one day, or after 1 week, or after 10 years, or never, because you are detained at the mercy of the president. And for me, it was very discouraging because one of the other political prisoners had been there for 10 years. So I was calculating, he's been here for 10 years. The least I can come out is after 10 years. So it's not very comforting thought, really, you know. But nevertheless, dreams of freedom, always, you know. You see birds flying and thoughts of freedom, you know, possess you. And there was one time when actually thoughts of became very, very strong in prison. And is I want to read one or two of those, what is one actually, and then remove my jacket.
Is your chair behind you?
Huh?
Chair behind you.
Where? Oh, yeah, thank you. I just come from Amherst 2 days ago. So to celebrate Amherst College was celebrate my 80th birthday. So, and what happened? The weather was very good for the first day. The following day, arrows of rain began.
We beat the nor'easter.
Yeah, you know. So I want to read. So there have been very many theories of people come with all sorts of reasons why would be released. There's nobody has the facts, but you come up with theory. And I want to read about one theory, which you describe as the Quran theory of freedom. There are many theories I talk about here, but one of it is Quran theory of freedom. It happened among the political prisoners, where also some who are Muslims. And you read the Quran quite a number of times and say prayers and sing. And it's really wonderful to have them around. With their singing, so I like their singing. I thought I didn't know they were prayers. So I didn't really, they were singing prayers. So I would tell them, can you at all times please sing? I thought they were songs. Okay. But anyway, one such premature jubilation, and of course we'd be very excited at this. Somebody comes with a very convincing theory and we would be very excited, which so not to be, and then which, you know, as the day come near, you felt, you know, maybe you might be right. So the Quran, one such premature jubilation was based on revelations from the Quran, what later came to be known as the Quran theory of freedom. Islam was introduced to the compound by members of the Kenya-Somali nationality. And they were the ones who led, you know, the prayers and so on. Islam and Christianity and their two rival books of God, the Quran and the Bible, contended for utterance at our camp. The military man and I were the only political prisoners who belonged to neither camp. Instead, we played a game of chess. Or else stand by and watch the proceedings from afar. Islam was the first and only one to make a dramatic conquest. One of our prisoners, called Adam, previously a Catholic, became a Muslim. The ceremony of conversion took place on a Monday and was watched by all the political prisoners. He became Adam Ahmed and he wore a Muslim cap. I did not see any Muslim become a Christian. I was fascinated by the two religions, especially by the differences between them, or what appeared to be different between them. The Muslims that committed believed in the literal truth of every word in the Quran, with no room for interpretation or metaphor. They told me that the Quran was not just a book, like the Torah of Judaism, they contained a way of life, culture, that regulated all of a person's actions. Because it looked more religious ritual, Islam seemed the more demanding of the two religions. Five prayers, sessions a day, and for those aspiring to religious leadership, recital the whole Quran from the first page to the last page once a week or something. For Islam's adherents, the Quran was a world. The Christian Bible, on the other hand, did not contain a rigid way of life, a totality of culture, or rules governing daily behavior. And for its adherents, especially committed prison, it was not a world. Christianity, certainly, was. Now, let me just go to the prophecy. So, now Sheikh Sharia read the Quran. He was a sheikh. And he saw stars scattering away and ocean roaring. And it was revealed to him that would be released on a day when we set up international rule, we call it Madaraka Day, and will be released by the grace of Jomo Kenyatta through the order would come, though the order would come from God. And he said the date, June 1, 1978. So that's June 1, 1978. So a high temperature of expectation, especially among the Muslims. Most non-Muslims express doubt about the veracity of the revelations, but we all hoped that the prophecy would come true, whether through revelation or coincidence, it didn't matter. The calm dignity with which the Sheikh kept on asserting the inevitability of our release, and the way he would smile confidence at the doubters, made some of us suspect that maybe some friendly of God has whispered vital information to him. But a systematic, though not open, inquiry among the other Muslims revealed that the entire revelation came from the Quran, which was a more reliable source of truth and prophecy. One Muslim political prisoner had even packed his luggage read to both freedom at any hour of the day or night. Nothing of our freedom came on the Madaraka Day. But so sure was he of the truth of the revelation that even on June 2nd, the newspaper then had not yet been stopped. The Sheikh asked that all papers should be read carefully for any clue or hint about our impending release. It turned out that Kenyatta's speech on Madaraka Day was the shortest ever, and it contained not a single word about the fate of political prisoners, except that actually, reading between the lines, we sense that something was wrong, that Kenyatta was actually ill. So the last dream of hero freedom was Kenyatta's death. You know, you think that if he dies, then natural death, then if he's ill, then we might become free, So when we learned about his death secretly, through hints, they would tell us he was dead. Because by law, if the person who put in detention without trial dies in office, then the new one was obligated to release you. But they didn't do that, they just kept us there, and they didn't even tell us that he was actually gone. Mm. But we knew. With Kenyatta's death, another dream of freedom possessed us all. And this time, even non-believers believe in the possibility. So, and then suddenly, Aruma started. We will be free on Friday, September the 22nd, 1978. The whole compound was gripped with feverish excitement and expectations. A week ago, a week to go, and we would all be free to talk with our families, see green life again, hear the sweet laughter of women and children. Food became completely tasteless. On a Tuesday evening, very few touched their prison food in expectation of the good food of freedom. We exchanged addresses and confidences and promises of future meetings. We started talking of detention, political imprisonment, and committed as things of history. Some of the prisoners had already arranged for a new tire sandals in which they would carry home as a remembrance of things past in prison tire, you know. The morning of Friday, September 2nd, found us still in a grip of hope. There had been no official word yet, but the room had become a reality. Why not? Every reasonable argument pointed to our release on that day. Some political prisoners had sat down, made a list of all the cabinet members and tried to determine their voting pattern in terms of yes or no to our release on that day. And naturally, the ministers in favor of our release outnumbered those against us. A political prisoner who cautioned realism in our expectations was shouted down and denounced as an enemy of the people. It was a kind of collective madness, I remember. When at about 10 o'clock, there was a vigorous banging on the outer door, and a prison officer dashed in, waving his staff of office. I said to myself, at long last, God, freedom. But others read something different. Quickly, Coy pulled me aside and whispered, "Go and clean your room at once. There's going to be a search." And he literally ran towards his own cell to do the same. I had never seen a prison cell before, and though the other political prisoners told me that under the previous officer, it had been a weekly ritual, I never really knew what it meant. So I wasn't sure what I expected to do, what I was expected to do, or how to prepare for it. And then two warders descended upon us from all sides, batons raised. Literally hounding us back to ourselves. There was no laughter in my eyes. My cell was first berated, and my novel on toilet paper was the first to be taken. The second section, which I don't want to read, is called Sherlock Holmes and the Straight Case of the Missing Novel, which you read, right? Yeah. Thank you.
We have time for maybe a couple of questions.
Yeah.
If anyone has any questions.
So the entire reason you were imprisoned was because of your writing and the plays, the theater, and they could just take you to prison and detain you?
Yeah. In a way, things that happened, this novel, Petals of Blood, Petal of Blood had come out in 1975. Yeah, 75. And this may have rubbed them in government the wrong way. Okay, so we're very critical of the post-colonial scene, not only in Kenya, but really in Africa. But the difference was this was in English, right? Yeah, very strong language in English. Guy Kadeda of Marijuana One was in an African language. It could be understood and was being performed by ordinary people. I mean, so literally, I mean, I don't have this. You read it I not read the sections, but you, for instance, let me see what I can show you. Not read, but show you. How, and you see some pictures here where you can see the working people constructing the theater, but imagine the theater, but they use matchsticks, okay, to imagine how it's going to be like and so on, you know. So that whole experience of any difference was in seeing. No, I have a theory, let me put it this way. Personally, I have a theory that government anywhere, whether in America or anywhere, they don't really like unawakened people.
No.
For reason being, if you, they like to tell people, to preach to people, hey, this is what I shall do for you. Huh? I'll do this for you. This is a plan I have for you. Really, this is what we can do. Huh? Always. I have this plan for you, this is what I do, A, B, C, D. Now, at the community, we are talking about what we can do. When I first went there, they were singing about me. We told them, no, we don't come here as saviors. We shall sing about what we collectively can do. Not only that, we shall sing what we have done. So many of the examples we shall be taking in the play must come from either people who are here in the play or people in the village, you know. If you talk about heroes, we're not going to talk about heroes who come from Nairobi or any other part of Kenya, for that matter. Let's talk about heroes who exemplify that heroism, but who come from the village. You know, it's we, the whole notion of we, as opposed to a savior out there, the savior that being government or a strong leader or whatever, you know. We sort of turned things around, you know. So seeing we, you know, we did this, you know, in history or whatever. So my own impression is that it's really the play, not the novel, that led me to prison. And I also know this because remember, I was not taken to a court of law. I was never charged with anything. It was literally from my own home to a maximum security prison in a section in the middle of the bed. This was one section was for those condemned on death row, and the other was for those who are mentally challenged. You know, so the writer was somewhere, you know, between those two. Anyway, yeah. So I think three writing. Performing in an African language, in this case, the language spoken in that community, you know. And remember that we don't have time, but to read the language is very, very important, you know. There's always an attempt to deny people their language or a language that can enable them to come to better grips with reality, you know. Because when you come to think of, you cannot change anything unless you know it. Huh? So knowledge cannot be, and knowledge, you need it in your own language, you know. You can have many other languages, that's okay. There's nothing wrong in having 20 or 30 languages to the one you have, but there's something really wrong and not quite right when the condition of, say, mastering English or French is denial of your own language, you know. Yeah. So I think that's to the language issue. Yeah. But obviously, let me be correct here, but obviously it's not just a language issue. It's also the fact that, of course, what either play or say great things about the government, they would have been quite happy. So it's not quite, you know, we have to be careful. I mean, it's not just the language per se. It's also what the play was probably saying. But the reason I have the language issue, because it's this. Petal the Blood had said similar things, but in a harsher way, and not prison for me. Mm-hmm. The play had said similar things in a more comical, more laughing kind of, and I was put in a maximum security prison, yeah. And later forced into exile, so it's not simply that.
So, are there preparations that you go through for your body, for your mind, meditation practices that allow you to inhabit that position of witness in history and in art? Do you have a practice of some type that prepares you or sustains you?
Me, not in the part of these days. I do not believe meditation, but actually, that is important. Meditation, one can get to that state. You know? But for me, I've been helped very much by imagination. You know that that as key moments in my life, that whole area of art, imagination, stories. You know, then is I'm able to inhabit that area. So I'm always very grateful to it, especially in this case, writing this novel in prison was actually very important to me. And became almost like a struggle, even if the whole challenge of writing the novel under hostile conditions becomes itself almost like a creative, like triggers adding creativity. Right? That's why I call it resistance in some way. Because I'm using, when I'm not, you know, it's not very pleasant, but when I say, wait a minute, president, I think you've seen presidents, and they're always guarded, correct? Mm-hmm. You know, you see them mm-hmm. with, you know. Me too, I was always guarded, night and day, you know, even going to the bathroom, there'll be guards standing by the door, okay? Well, president get food cooked for them. Yes, me too. It's not the best of food, but it's brought to me. I had a bed, I had a room, house, free housing. That's when you're in a good mood. In the reality, it's very, very. What you're denied is connection with the daily struggles of other human beings, right? And this is where imagination then comes to help. Because you are really, you do actually create a world in which people are struggling. They are, you know, they struggle for food, clothes, they are quarreling, they are laughing, they are crying, they are laughing, you know. So you can, you're actually inhabiting that world. But at the same time, I knew that I was resisting because I was writing in a language which had been the basis of my incarceration. So, see, when I was in prison, see, I was fighting back because I've been put in prison for writing in a given language. Now, in prison, guarded day and night, I'm actually writing a novel in that language. And I'm using toilet paper they have given me as my writing material, you know, and hiding it. There's nowhere to hide it. So, I find a way of hiding it. You read about it here, actually, in hiding it publicly, right? There was nowhere to hide it. But I can show you. Since the banner of toilet paper was square like this, I realized if I looked on the ones which were in the middle and put them back, and the one at the bottom and the top were not you put them back, nobody can tell from the side. It looks as if it's an unused bundle of toilet paper. Then on my table, I scattered the ones I didn't want, I scattered around there. So initially when, and you read about this, initially when they came for that search, they saw the pieces of paper on the table and they pounced on those as they now had been writing. But they were about to leave, they saw this other pile. And then they threw a new rule. I have to have only two bundles at any one time. So what I do with this pile of, So it was confiscated. That's how they now kept it. The entire, now you can, you're going to read about it here. It's like a death sentence. Yeah, a whole year. All of it, I saw it in the paper knowledge. I use that as a teaser, so you can find out what happened.
To live in those conditions, and to take action, to resist, is to understand the element of being alive. That's the most basic impulse for the life, isn't it? Is that a teaching?
I think I read in resistance. Okay, let me put it this way. Quickly. Change, life. We know that a human, let's say our blood is circulating all the time. That's why we know we are alive. We know heart is if we stop beating, wait a minute, but just now, you're like, blood is circulating. There are so many things that are moving inside us all the time. Movement. Right? Then we know we are alive. We start that movement, there's no, actually there's no life. Okay? So, existence is really, struggle, let me put the word struggle. I like the word struggle really, It's part of the livingness of, really, whether human or plants, that's struggle. The thing is to struggle, then we know.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Skylight Books author reading series. Don't forget, you can listen to this and all of our other great podcasts at skylightbooks.com. Thanks again for stopping by, and we hope to see you soon.